My first reaction to Fotina when it started coming out was incredibly negative. I don't remember the watch, but I remember my reaction. You know, the first time I saw it, I thought to myself, what the hell is this nonsense? What is this ersatz, phony baloney, bullshit,
how many times a day?
Shot, insincere, laughably pathetic attempt to steal fire from genuinely vintage watches is this?
How many times a day do you think, what is this nonsense?
You know, if you're a person with a sort of naturally, generally aggrieved posture towards life, watches are a great thing to get into because there's always something to be upset about.
True, yeah. Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. There is nobody better around Hodinkee HQ if you want to go for a deep dive into something than Mr. Jack Forrester. And recently, he ran two stories on the site that I wanted to bring him into the studio to talk a little bit about. So one is an ode to the mainspring, this often forgotten part of watchmaking, and Jack somehow makes this tiny little piece of metal tell a 500-year-plus story. Then we go to something more aesthetically focused, an article about Fotina and the faux aging of watches. This is a hot topic. People have lots of opinions. There were almost 200 comments on the story at the time we recorded this. And Jack sheds a little bit of light and gives a little bit of context to this thing that everyone seems to have an opinion about. After that, Ben and I sit down with Eric Wind, who you might know as the proprietor and founder of Wind Vintage, but he's actually a longtime friend and a Hodinkee OG. He was one of our earliest contributors, and the three of us sit around and talk about all manner of things vintage watches. We talk about Eric's time in the auction world, we talk about how the market's been changing over the last decade, and Eric even offers a couple of tips into watches that you should be looking at right now. Without further ado, let's get into it. This week's episode is brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop. Stay tuned later in the show to learn more about how the Hodinkee Shop is changing the watch buying game. For more, visit shop.hodinkee.com.
There is no such thing as room tone. There's no such thing as room tone. Not in this dump.
Room tone. testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Hey Jack, how's it going?
Going great.
It's Friday morning, man.
It is.
It's we're in our toasty library here in a chilly New York City.
Yep.
Talking about two long form stories you wrote.
Yes.
Which are really, in my opinion, the best kind of Jack Forrester stories.
I don't seem to be able to write any other kind, so you know.
That is very true. As someone who has been editing you for years, that is very, very true.
Yeah.
So we got two stories here, and you know what they share in common is they're both deep dives, but otherwise they're pretty different, I would say. One is very technical, and one is much more aesthetic and design oriented. So I figure we'll start with the technical stuff, and then we'll end up in the design stuff. That sound good to you?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So story one, in depth, consider the mainspring.
Yeah, so I had some time off in December. Actually, it was the first sort of real long vacation that I've taken since starting at Hodinkee, which was I was a little antsy at first, but it was actually nice to unplug for a bit. But I had time to think some things over and to spend some time with the family, and I had several conversations with my older son about an idea that he had for a sort of historical fantasy fiction, science fiction kind of story. And his idea was, what would have happened if the Roman Empire and the Chinese Empire had actually both undergone different kinds of industrial revolutions and had actually met on the field of battle at some point? This led to several even longer conversations between the two of us about, you know, why it was that these industrial revolutions actually hadn't happened and what would be necessary in order for them to happen. And one of the things that we, you know, sort of discovered was that, you know, for a real industrial revolution, you need to be able to produce large quantities of high-grade steel. And that, by a very roundabout route, led me to start thinking about one of the least thought about and least appreciated parts of a watch, which is the mainspring. So the cool thing about mainsprings is that if you don't have a spiral spring to drive the clockwork mechanism, you basically can't have watches. The very first timepieces, the very first clocks were basically weight-driven. So the way a weight-driven clock works is you basically take something heavy. It can be a rock. It can be a chunk of pig iron. It can be, you know, a basket full of bricks, or, you know, it can be, you know, a Hodinkee editor. You wind the rope around the hub of a gear wheel, and then you set up a gear train that has the weight at one end and the escapement at the other. The escapement regulates how fast the weight falls, how fast the weight can fall. You know, and then you basically got a clock. You just stick a hand on whichever wheel turns, you know, twice a day or once a day, and that's the hour hand, and that's the simplest kind of clock that you can have. But that obviously does not work for a portable timepiece. Right. So for a portable timepiece, you need an escapement that is not a pendulum, and right. You need a power source that is not a falling weight. So the escapement part, you know, that was kind of sorted out, you know, by the 1500s verge escapement. You know, by modern standards, not a very good escapement, but, you know, it works. But spiral springs were a tougher nut to crack because a mainspring has to do something which is really challenging metallurgically speaking. You have to be able to wind it up tightly, and then it has to be able to discharge its force over whatever the running time of the watch is, 24 hours, 2 days, 3 days, or what have you. And it has to be able to do that over and over and over and over again without breaking. And the thing about steels and a lot of other materials is that if you flex them often enough, you start to get a phenomenon called metal fatigue. And this involves, you know, basically slippages in the crystalline structure of the material, which eventually form cracks large enough to fail under stress. And, you know, a mainspring stores a lot of energy. So breaking, you know, when mainsprings break, it is potentially a catastrophe for the watch or for the clock because a lot of energy is being discharged all at once. Being able to make these things, you know, we kind of take mainsprings for granted, and nobody really thinks about them much nowadays. It's like, you know, in any watch, it's the one part that is for sure not a high craft, one at a time, handmade component. You know, like Roger Smith uses industrially made mainsprings that are not all that different from the mainsprings that you find in entry level mechanical watches. But you go back to the sort of pre-industrial revolution era, or, you know, right up to the sort of end of the 19th century, really. And mainsprings were actually quite hard to produce because making high quality steel was not something that was done on an industrial basis. It was actually something that was done on an artisanal basis. There were certain ores that were favored because they just produced better quality steel, and nobody really knew why. And over hundreds and thousands of years, you know, steel's been around for, you know, several thousand years, but really, really high-grade steel, the knowledge to make it is something that was actually passed down from master to apprentice, and, you know, in many cases from father to son. There were trade secrets around it, which were not shared with other workers typically. You know, so I started researching this, and it turns out that making a mainspring for much of the history of watchmaking was done by, it's still done by specialists, but it was done historically by specialist craftsmen, and that's all they did. And the process had, you know, dozens and dozens of steps. It required a very high degree of craft. It required the ability to observe the temperature of metal accurately, you know, judged by the color of the glow that the heated metal produced. It required an understanding of how steels respond to different kinds of working, to, you know, being hammered or being drawn out. It required a understanding of the way in which steels respond to quenching. So if you heat up a piece of steel to a certain color, and if you dunk it in water or oil and the temperature drops really quickly, that produces a certain kind of internal crystalline structure. If you let it cool off slowly, that produces a very different kind of crystalline structure. So all of these things, and, you know, these were all rules of thumb. The actual sort of scientific, metallurgic, chemical, and crystallographic basis for understanding how you get high-grade spring steel consistently, that came long, long after mainsprings, you know, were started to be produced for watches and clocks.
So people were literally just doing this by feel. Like, they didn't know why it worked. They just knew that, like, okay, if you heat it up to approximately this orangey-red color, you let it sit for 6 minutes, and then you dunk it in some oil, it'll work. If you heat it up to a slightly brighter color of orange and only wait 5 minutes, it's going to break and not work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, so you get smaller crystals, for instance, if you cool a metal very quickly. You get larger crystals if you let it cool more slowly. And although there was not really an understanding of the crystal structure of steel, you know, in the Middle Ages, for instance, you look at swords that were being produced in places like Damascus and places like Japan, there was a really, really high level of empirical understanding of the effects of different ways of working steel and different ways of quenching steel on the crystal structure of the metal. So a high-grade Japanese sword, the high-grade katana, has a relatively soft, relatively flexible central core, but out by the edge where you want smaller crystals because it produces a much sharper cutting edge than large crystals. You have very, very small crystals. And the way that they achieved that was by basically heat painting the sword with a slurry of clay and iron filings to different thicknesses along the length of the sword. And that way you would get different cooling rates when you actually quench the weapon. And so there was sort of similar stuff going on, or a similar level of understanding going on, in the manufacture of mainsprings by hand. Which was, you know, as I said, it was a very long, drawn-out business. And really, really good mainspring manufacturing was such a specialist art that most watchmakers didn't even attempt it themselves. They would actually buy mainsprings from specialist manufacturers, which varied in quality. And the good ones, really good mainsprings, were quite expensive. When watchmaking and clockmaking got started in the United States, we didn't have the ability here at first to manufacture mainsprings at all. So they had to be, if you were an American clockmaker, and you're drinking buddies with Paul Revere, you're not getting your mainsprings from the United States. They have to be imported from overseas. It's super, super expensive, and it's difficult to be competitive with actual finished clocks, you know, coming in from Europe as well.
So, do you think since those days, since this has become a pretty standardized industrial process, do you think we've lost something? Like, is there something there that you think is missing, or is this actually just like a good thing that now this sort of like scientific headache has been figured out?
I mean, I think it's a cool thing to know about. I mean, I think it's a cool thing to know about, obviously, because I spent countless hours researching the least loved component in the watch. Yeah, you know, whenever craft techniques disappear, I think something is lost. It would probably be possible to duplicate some of the techniques. One of my main sources for the article was a translation of a text that had actually been written by a mainspring maker who sort of described the different steps in his process in the 1700s. It would be possible to some degree to reproduce these techniques, but, you know, you wouldn't be working with, an ore from a specific part of the world necessarily that, had particular properties. And it would, I think most people would regard it as more trouble than it's worth. You know, you take techniques like this and you displace them in time. You change the circumstances around them, and it gets difficult to get the same product.
Yeah, I think all of this brings up a broader question about mechanical watchmaking, right? Which is that everyone listening to this knows that, like, you know, a $10 quartz watch that you get from the drugstore, right, is a better timekeeper. It's a more effective timekeeper than the finest handmade watch, right? And in a similar way, you said that, you know, a handmade artisanal mainspring at this point is going to be much less effective, much less reliable, much less, it won't have the same sort of longevity that right. A industrial made mainspring would have.
And, you know, and critically, it won't deliver power as smoothly over the course of its entire power reserve, which is something modern mainsprings, which incidentally are very, very complex metallurgically. That's something that modern mainsprings do extremely well.
Right. But at the core, to a certain degree, especially at the high end, mechanical watchmaking isn't about those things anymore, right? It's about the art. It's about the sort of craft. It's about the appreciation of doing things the old-fashioned way. So I wonder, for you, you know, we won't call out any names. I won't put any of our watchmaking friends on the carpet here, but are there certain watchmakers that you wish still did make their own mainsprings, even if they weren't technically as good, just because they would be handmade and they would add that kind of last little element?
I mean, I think it would be a really cool thing for somebody to try and do, but there's no money in it.
Right.
You know, I mean, even at the, you know, highest end, you know, sort of artisanal watchmaking, I would love one day to own a Roger Smith watch. I would also love one day to actually be affluent enough to own a Roger Smith watch.
You and me both, my friend.
Which is another conversation. But I think he does absolutely gorgeous stuff. But, you know, he doesn't use piercing saws and or piercing files and saws to cut out his main plates and bridges. Those are cut out on CNC cutting machines, on computer-guided cutting machines, and for a reason. You know, when you're making watches in series, you're not, if the customer is concerned to have something that represents craft and that represents the history of craft, well, you know, you're just not giving them anything by insisting on roughing out large components the old-fashioned way. It's very, very time-consuming. It produces much, much lower precision. It's much, much harder to end up with a watch that's going to run well, especially if you're using an escapement, which is very... I mean, all escapements are highly, highly sensitive to precision in manufacture. The coaxial escapement, more so than the lever.
Mm-hmm.
And there just wouldn't be... There sort of wouldn't be any point other than being able to say, well, I did this. You know, I mean, it's not... the mainspring sits in a barrel. Unless it's a skeletonized watch, it's not visible. And it doesn't look particularly different from a modern mainspring when it's sitting there. It's never going to be a beautiful thing to look at. So you're talking about something that would add an enormous amount of time, energy, effort, and complexity to the watch for a significant reduction in the performance of the watch, and which moreover adds nothing to the aesthetic experience of the watch and is purely an abstract mental satisfaction. So it's not like it's not hard to understand why nobody's pursued it.
So that's a no.
Right.
Right. Yeah, no, I think all of that makes a lot of sense, Jack. And I would say to anyone listening, if you're the kind of person who finds yourself defending the idea of like a handmade watch and a mechanical watch, and you kind of want to explain to other people how much goes into that, even to a very basic modern mechanical watch, send this article on to people. We'll link it up in the show notes if you haven't read it already. But this to me really sums up kind of how even the most unappreciated kind of industrialized part of modern watchmaking has so much history and so much backstory that is almost unintelligible just by looking at the part. You really have to go dig deeper.
Yeah, I obviously completely agree. And, the modern mainspring is the end result of a 500-year struggle to get these things to work properly.
And here we are. All right, Jack, let's move on. Let's do article number 2. This is about a hot topic here on Hodinkee, something that...
We're going to move from something that almost nobody cares about to something everybody seems to care about.
Yeah, something everyone seems to care about and something that everyone seems to have a very impassioned opinion about and seems to think they are absolutely right about. This article has 182 comments on it. It was published just a couple days ago. In depth, Fotina, the histories, and the pros and cons. For people who don't know, Fotina refers to... the color of luminous material on a watch dial that makes it look aged and makes it look like a vintage watch. So that kind of orangey, creamy colored loom, it can refer to other things like dials that have fake sort of like patination on them and other sorts of things. But predominantly and mostly what this article is concerned about is this idea of loom that instead of being bright white is yellow or cream colored or orange in order to look like tritium or radium instead of luminova.
Right.
People love it. People hate it. You may or may not, Jack, have coined the term Fotina.
I mean, the funny thing is, it's actually very difficult to find out what firsts are sometimes on the internet, especially when you're talking about internet phenomena that took place on technology platforms that, in some cases no longer exist or that have been so heavily modified that they're not really, searchable in terms of what people were talking about, back in the early 2000s. So, on watch forums, for instance, there was a time when watch forums really kind of like ruled the day in watch discourse. This is before Instagram took off, before social media took off. And these forums were the first places that people kind of gathered to talk about watches, digitally. And prior to that, there were electronic bulletin board services. So people have been talking about watches for almost as long as there has been an internet available for people to talk about watches on. But it's really hard to find out who coined the term. And it's actually fairly difficult to find out which watch it was that first used a loom that was deliberately intended to look like vintage loom. So in the course of researching this story, one of the nice things about timezone.com is that they have archived, there's a ton of discussions and a ton of articles on the site, which are archived all the way back, to the very early 2000s, and in some cases even before. And it took quite a bit of digging, but I finally managed to push back the date for which the first Fotina loom watch appeared to 2008.
Okay.
It was Gégé Lecôtre Memovox tribute to Polaris.
Oh, yeah. That watch is great.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting phenomenon. The comments... on that particular watch at the time, you know, back in 2008, you know, a lot of the comments ran to, oh, wow, that's so cool. They actually colored the loom so it looks like a vintage watch. And, you know, there were other reactions to it as well, which were, what the hell are they doing? I hate that pre-aged loom. It looks so phony baloney. Why couldn't they have just, you know, left it white and let it age naturally? And,
I mean, the answer is it would not age naturally.
Well, yeah, it certainly wouldn't age the same way. I mean, Superluminova does not age the way tritium does. It's not been out for all that long, actually. Superluminova is a relatively recent phenomenon. It's been around since, I want to say 97, I think, Rolex, 97, 98. Rolex switched over gradually from using tritium to using Superluminova. And I would guess that's about the same time as the rest of the industry did. Mm. It's just easier to work with, you know, than a radioactive substance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fade over time the way tritium does.
Right.
But, you know, one of the great things about posting stories like this is, you know, Hodinkee's widely read enough by enough people who've been around long enough that if you publish a story like this, you often hear from people whose memory is better than yours and who recall things that you have forgotten. And there's a couple of people who've actually mentioned a Panerai watch, which goes back which was released in 2004, which, to me, looks unquestionably like now the earliest, you know, so the story's already out of date, you know, thank you, Internet. But but I never would have found that out if I hadn't published the story. So, you know, this watch looks unambiguously like an attempt to use sort of yellowish or beige-colored loom as a way of reproducing the look of aged radium, in this case, an aged radium dial, aged tritium dial in other cases. And a couple of other people mentioned some interesting, you know, early cases as well of colored loom, which were not... you could kind of make a case that they were examples of Fotina, so to speak, but they looked to me more like, you know, just sort of design decisions because they were designed to match other elements on the dial. So there's a Milgauss, for instance, which had orange-colored dial markers, but it also had orange-colored numerals.
Yeah.
So I think that was just a matching dial elements issue. And there was a Blancpain limited edition, which is also mentioned in the comments. Really, really interesting looking watch, bright orange, luminous material. But again, I think that was really more of a design decision than an attempt to mimic the look of vintage per se.
Yeah. I mean, I got to be honest. I've said this, I think, before here on the pod, but I am a fan of Fotina in many cases, not for the effect it creates of reproducing a vintage watch, but for its effect of being less sort of arresting on the eyes. I often find, especially with black dials, having bright white plots is just so, it's distracting. It takes away from things. I find it to be too stark. I find it to be too clean. Like it feels off. And I find like a slight off-white, like a slight creaminess to it. It makes it easier for me to read and easier to appreciate the dial. And if the dial has a bit of texture, like, it doesn't overwhelm as much. So for no other reason than just like pure aesthetics, I think I'm on board the Fotina train.
I mean, I think there's something to be said for that. We should get one of our designers in here to confirm this. But my understanding has always been that in web page design, for instance, you don't want text body to be white text against a black background because it's just it's a little too hard to read.
It's hard on the eyes.
Yeah, it's hard on the eyes. Yeah, exactly. And you know, the more that I look at you know, some of the more subtle watches with tinted, shall we say, loom that have come out in recent years, I think the industry's gotten better at doing it in a more subtle way. But it doesn't. It really does seem to reduce some of the, I don't know, glare seems like too strong a word, but like that high contrast white on black that you were talking about. Yeah, it can be a little hard on the eyes sometimes.
Yeah.
It makes the watch look a little too. It makes the watch look a little sterile.
Yeah.
And I think giving a little, you know, sort of beige coloration to the loom actually gives the watch, in some cases, I think better legibility. It's easier on the eyes and just a general, you know, sort of warmth.
Yeah,
I agree. Which is a little bit nicer to have on your wrist than something that's, you know, like, you know, so high contrast.
Yeah. It's funny, too, because there are watches where, like, I'm perfectly willing to contradict myself here, where, like, the Black Bay 58, for example, I love the off-white loom on the Black Bay 58.
Yeah.
The Rolex Submariner, however, to me looks perfect with bright white loom. Like, the chromolite and bright white that glows blue, like... That to me is exactly what that watch needs. If they rolled out a Submariner with like creamy loom, I'd be like, huh?
Yeah,
this doesn't feel quite right. Like something about this watch demands that it be crisp and sharp and perfect. You know, like a modern sub should be black and white, super high contrast, like whatever. Yet the Black Bay 58 feels great, or even one of the other Black Bay models. Mm-hmm. So it's funny how these watches, something as small as like a few tonal changes in the loom, like a tiny hint of color, just completely changes the character of the watch.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this in the story. There was the 2008 JLC Polaris Memovox Limited Edition. They did another version in 2018, and the one from 2018, the loom is much, much more subtle. It's actually kind of it's easy to miss that the loom is actually off-white rather than straight white the first time you look at it. But it gives the watch this really, really nice sort of, you know, slightly warm feel that a lot of modern watches don't have, without it feeling like the company's trying to hit you over the head with good old days, vibe.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wonder, were there any comments specifically that you saw that made you kind of like shake your head as you were perusing them?
I mean, you know, the one thing about, I say this at the top of the story, there are certain kinds of discussions that revolve around either or choices, and there are really strong feelings on both sides of the question.
Yeah.
And there's a tendency to sort of not go past that. And, you know, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything really wrong with that per se. I mean, people come to read Hodinkee because they have strong feelings about watches. So, you know, thank God, you know, and you see those in the comments. And, you know, and thank God they do. I think there's room for a lot of different opinions on this thing, on this particular issue, as with many other things. But it still kind of blows me away how absolutist and doctrinaires, all of us can be in some of our tastes. I mean, when I my first reaction to Fotina when it started coming out in the, 2006, 2007, 2008, during that period, my first reaction was incredibly negative. And again, I mentioned this in the story, but I don't remember the watch, but I remember my reaction. You know, the first time I saw it, I thought to myself, what the hell is this nonsense? What is this ersatz, phony baloney bullshit?
How many times a day?
Shot, insincere, just laughably pathetic attempt to steal fire from genuinely vintage watches is this?
How many times a day do you think, what is this nonsense?
I pretty much wake up and go to sleep.
Okay, perfect.
Thinking not about watches necessarily, but other things. But
perfect.
If you're a person with a sort of naturally, generally aggrieved posture towards life, watches are a great thing to get into because there's always something to be upset
it's
about.
True, yeah.
But it's my view on this has changed over the years. I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome or whatever. I'm just tired of sustaining outrage over something that's ultimately fairly insignificant. But it just doesn't bother me all that much anymore. I mean, I think I think that there are certainly, as you were saying earlier, there are definitely instances where it's better done than others. I like my Fotina to be on the subtle side. I feel like it's somebody in the comments said that heavy-handed Fotina felt a little bit too much like LARPing.
Yeah.
Stands for live action role playing. You know, this is people who enjoy playing Dungeons and Dragons. They actually dress up in a magic user costume or a warrior costume, and they go out and they sort of act out a Dungeons and Dragons adventure.
Yeah.
And it does have kind of that LARPing / old time TYME,
yeah,
Renaissance fair kind of feel. It's like, it's fun for 5 minutes, but you definitely wouldn't want to live in a period where there were no antibiotics or flush toilets.
Yeah.
And Fotina at its worst, you're just kind of like, come on. I still, when I see it done badly, my reaction is still like, oh, come on, man.
All right. So I want to ask, the last thing I want to talk about is about whether we've seen peak Fotina. So Breguet, for Only Watch this past year, released a special Type 20, a unique piece that has a chocolatey brown, like faux tropical dial with this creamy loom in the hands and on the numerals. The watch, basically, it's like a fake tropical Type 20. Mm-hmm. I happen to think the watch is rather handsome, despite the fact that I'm normally not a tropical dial person. But this to me is like, this is not even Fotina. This is like, we've gone full on like reproducing vintage watches, basically, with all of their aesthetic peccadillos, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's kind of like, this is as far as we can push it, or as far as it will be pushed, or do you think people are going to keep pushing forward?
there are two watches that I think of in the context of have we reached peak Fotina. One of them is the Breguet Type 24 only watch, the unique piece that you mentioned, and the other is the new Omega Speedmaster with the caliber 321 in steel, which also has tinted lume. The interesting thing to me about both of those watches is that they actually, vintage through and through. The Breguet actually uses a vintage Valjoux flyback chronograph movement.
It's true.
So it's as, it's consistent, from the case design to the dial design to the mechanism inside, it actually delivers in terms of the mechanics on what the exterior promises. I mean, for me, one of the biggest disconnects is when you have a modern, sort of mass produced, current production, modern movement, inside a sort of old timey case, it just sort of feels like the inside is letting down the outside a little bit.
Yeah.
And then of course with the Caliber 321 Speedmaster, the Caliber 321 went out of production in, I think it was 67 or 68. Boy, as a diehard Speedmaster fan, I should have that date memorized.
I wasn't going to give you a hard time, but I agree.
And, it's been out of production for decades, and they have brought back the movement, which is a whole nother topic of conversation. Some people love it. Some people hate it. But, again, it's a watch that is consistent, through and through in terms of its adherence to not only vintage design cues but vintage movement engineering. And, both of those movements, the one in the Breguet and the one in the Speedmaster, those were really, really fantastic movements. They're really fantastic watches. Both the Breguet and the 321 Speedmaster, the modern 321 steel Speedmaster. I mean, those are both watches that I would really enjoy wearing and owning, I think. And, that's a situation where I think the fact that there is, a consistent connection to the past in every aspect, the design in terms of the physical construction of the case, the aesthetics in terms of the dial and hands and the movement. To me, that really makes the whole thing sort of sit up and sing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think, there's a big difference between, putting lipstick on a pig and making something that's like a genuine callback through and through.
Yeah, if you put an electric, a modern lithium battery powered electric engine in a Jaguar E-Type, I mean, it's kind of cool on a certain level, but it just doesn't, it feels a little like, I don't know.
Yeah, agreed. Well, awesome, man. We're going to link this one up in the show notes, too. So if you haven't read it, please read it and then also leave a comment. Let us know what you think. Again, this is a pretty hot button issue. And, as hot button, I guess, as an aesthetic issue about watches can be. And we'd love to hear what people have to say. So thanks for sitting down. Thanks for writing these articles. And
sure.
Hopefully you're working on something else.
Oh, lots of stuff.
Thanks, Jack. Up next, Ben and I sit down with vintage watch expert and Hodinkee OG Eric Wind. Hey guys, we got some like old school Hodinkee action going on here.
Yeah, we got Blake and Felix. Who else do we have?
Yeah, the whole crew.
I'm just kidding. Shout out to Blake and Felix.
Yeah, we got the whole 2012 crew going on.
Yeah,
we got Mr. Eric Wind up in here.
Thanks so much.
Good to see you. Here.
It's awesome.
How's 2020 going so far?
It's going really well. Got my daughter's teeth are coming in, so
fun. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Momentous. And Charlie's getting ready to lose his baby teeth, so we got...
Oh, man. A lot of teeth situations going on.
That's the focus the right teeth. Now.
How's Charlie's golf swing?
It's good.
This guy is like, I would put money behind this guy. He's got the real deal.
People have offered money. We haven't taken it yet.
But, how old is he?
He's just turned 6.
He's just turned 6. And he has like an actual golf swing, pops the ball in the air, really does it.
Yeah, he does. And they actually have tournaments starting locally at age 6. So we're excited to do that this spring.
Can he play? And then we'll quickly
this.
Can he play like a full 9? Can he like putt and everything?
Yeah, we play a par 3, which is incredible in Palm Beach. Mm-hmm. So the farthest back he goes is about 150 yards.
That's pretty far for a 6-year-old.
Yeah, he's had in the last sort of 4 rounds, he's had 3 birdies, which is insane.
What? That's
there's
crazy.
Like a 70-yard hole. He'll hit it like 8 feet and then make the putt, and he's done that 3 times. So yeah, it's insane. It's just I have to work on consistency, but he's
well, he's six.
He can really.
He's six. Yeah, exactly. He's six. He'll be A-okay. Yeah. But,
yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's
so crazy. It's insane, particularly when he makes a birdie and I don't. I'm like, oh jeez.
When you get beat doing anything by your 6-year old, except like maybe crawling into a tiny space. You know, yeah, other than exactly. that, like
yeah. It's insane and it's great to see his focus and attention, you know, just to sit there and hit 100 balls on the range and everything
wild.
Else. It's great.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really fun.
Nice. Also to start the year, you guys down there had the Miami Beach Antique Show, right?
Yeah.
How was that?
That was great. It was much earlier than normal because of the Super Bowl being in Miami. Typically it's in February.
Oh yeah.
So the NFL, I think, rented out the convention center for all of February. So they had to move it to early January. So it was a little quieter because a lot of, you know, we had set up on January 2nd and 3rd, which is kind of ridiculous. And a lot of the Europeans who typically come did not come because they were still celebrating Christmas there. But
Christmas is like a 2-month long.
Yeah, thing. Exactly. Yeah.
Mostly for Italians.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody works in December or January. Yeah, exactly. Just take the time.
Yeah, so that it was a little quieter, but it was really nice. It was my second year having a booth there, and I enjoyed meeting people and sold a few watches. I was happy.
Nice. Well, I wanted to kind of start this off by going like all the way back to the beginning. So we'll start, Eric, with you like way, way at the beginning. How did you end up interested in watches?
I think the first point was when I inherited my grandfather's watch. Now, I was always interested in watches before that. I had a G.I. Joe watch when I turned 5.
Nice.
But it was a Hamilton that was a gift from my grandfather to my grandmother for their wedding in 1947. And after they both passed, my mom got it and gave it to me, you know, as a gift. And that was what got me started in this interest in mechanical things. It was my first mechanical watch.
Cool.
And then around that time, summer of 2008, Hodinkee started, and I came across it very early on like a men's style blog somehow.
I think it was men.style.com.
Men.style.com.
Yeah, exactly. Which should have been GQ.com. Yeah. Which is like the most amazing like misuse of a domain I could ever think of.
Exactly.
Shout out to Condé Nast on that one.
Although men.style.com after tumblr.com might be the most shouted out website on this podcast.
Yes. That's probably true. Yeah. That's probably true. Yeah.
And then it was like 10 of the most desirable vintage watches, I think. And there was Paul Newman Daytona, which I thought was just so cool. James Bond's Mariner, etc. And then I suddenly was reading this gentleman's posts every day about different vintage watches. I remember there was a Seiko Rally Diver he posted from watchestobuy.com, which still exists, same website decades later. Eric Dyer, and it was $395. I was like, I want that, and I bought it and loved it. And then it all continued from there. I was then sort of emailing Ben occasional things I saw on eBay and on dealer websites. I mean, the dealer websites, they were like 5 at the time. It was like yorktime.com, watchestobuy.com.
Yorktime was Rod, right?
Yes. Yeah, he's still around.
Shout out to Rod, wherever you are.
Yeah, he's still in Canada. Classicwatch.com, like losttimes.com, a few others. Yeah, it was just interesting. And then you got into journalism school in May 2010, and I had found this cool website dedicated to the pole router, which I think still exists, polerouter.de, and the story of the pole router, Genta being 23, and I was 23. I was like, this would be a cool story for you, Ben. And then Ben wrote back and said, actually, you want to write about it? I'm starting journalism school shortly, looking for more writers. Mm-hmm. I can't pay you anything.
Yeah.
I
said, still can't.
Exactly.
Don't ask.
I said, yeah, that'd be awesome. And then the rest was history. I was just really bit by the bug and enjoyed writing the pieces. And I mean, just to have a view into what Hodinkee has become today has been pretty special.
Yeah, and that was the same time that we had Blake Bettner, Felix Schultz, Jason Heaton join as freelancers as well. Yeah, that was a fun time.
They joined right after me, so I have seniority. And, and then it was track? Like yeah. a week or two after.
No one's keeping score. But if we were,
mine was
we
were first. Keeping score. And then John Reardon.
And, yeah.
Shortly after that, I came up to New York and we went to a Sotheby's preview, I think. Mm. And we saw Charles Turrell and Nate Borgeld at Antiquorum. And you took a video of the Ethiopian caterpillar. Basically,
oh man, the Ethiopian caterpillar.
Still and the yeah,
and it was on, you know, your little Canon camera. I was right there, and that still like lives on today.
Still lives video. On. That video is like literally like the most painful thing to our entire video department. Like, you know, happiness. Yeah, this was shot on like a Canon S95 handheld at yes. Sotheby's. Yeah. Like Catherine Thomas pulled it out.
Yeah,
maybe it's like an 8 second long clip.
It's like the stupid video of this, like, you know. I don't even know how to describe it.
Yeah, it just goes up and down.
It's like a little automaton.
Yeah, a little automaton, yeah. But like tiny, like 4 inches long or something like that. And like, I just put it online.
It's like an 8 second video.
Yeah, it's like meaningless. It's like no production, just uploaded the raw file. And it like has like millions of views. Yeah. Like just like so many
Because didn't
views.
Like CNN or somebody
Somehow,
embedded it?
It ended up on like CNN.com, like MSNBC, and all these like mainstream news sites. Like I still don't really know why. Yeah. But yeah, it has more views than like Talking Watches with John Mayer.
And it was...
Sorry,
it was It was so funny. Because you know I was right there for it, and then a week later you're like, this thing has got the most hits ever. You're
that was when I learned like what the internet actually is. Like it just makes no sense. You create this like wonderfully produced, beautiful like magnum opus, and then like, you know, have the stupid thing that meant nothing and get like 25x the number of views.
Yeah,
that's the internet.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. It's funny, I forgot that you wrote that pole router thing, because I was going to bring up the fact that you're actually the one who introduced Ben and me.
Yes.
Because you read the blog I was doing at the time when I was a student. And I saw,
what was that called?
It was called Simply Refined. Okay. It's still online.
It hasn't been touched. How would you describe your
taste? Back then, like real old school.
Like Simply Refined.
Like 19th century old school. Like real old school.
Yeah.
Like certainly not wearing a baseball hat. Right. Like I'm doing
on
right
Wednesday.
Now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we got connected, but it's funny because also a pole router was the first vintage watch I bought.
Yep.
Which I ended up actually buying from Ben's cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which I still have, wore on my wedding.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's funny because now, you know, we spend all this time, like every story goes through like a pitch process and a vetting process. And we have often like a photographer and a video producer and a writer and two editors. And like, it's this whole big production, but people forget back then it was like Ben or Eric just being like,
oh my God.
Hey, this is a thing that's interesting. I'm going to write about it in 20 minutes between classes or like on the bus or whatever. And it's just like, that's how it happened.
I'm not really a bus guy.
Okay.
But
all right.
I'm
You're
maybe
not
like
a bus
Subway.
Guy?
But yeah. I mean, I was in journalism school at the time. You were still at Georgetown or you were at Oxford?
No, I was working.
Okay.
So I was like just staying late at work in a consulting firm in DC writing. And people are like, why are you here so late? I'm like writing about watches.
Which I'm sure is the answer they expected, right?
Yeah. And then you went on to Oxford.
Yes.
And did that for a year?
Yep. And the three of us, Ben, Stephen, and me, we went out for dinner when you guys were
With Jack and Jack Carlson.
Yeah.
Who's now the founder of the very famous
Rowing Blazers,
which is right down the block.
Yep.
Yeah. Everything is connected.
It's all connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He ordered, I think, a plate of
French fries.
Yeah, French fries, right.
Yeah.
And I remember the waiter looking at him like he had nine heads.
Yeah,
we were at an Italian restaurant, by the way.
But I mean, we were at what's it called?
The Ciccone's.
Yes. In London, very chic restaurant in particular back then.
Yes.
And he's like, I'll just have a plate of French fries. And the guy was like, okay.
That was crazy.
Like for his entree, for his main dish.
And Stephen was wearing double monks from Spain, custom
Being
made.
Pretty. Pretty awesome. Hashtag menswear back then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. You were. It was good. Yeah.
Those were the days, man.
Those were the days. And now we're here.
And now we're here.
And you
now
were working on the Drake's collaboration at the time, I think.
Oh, that we were. Yeah.
And Steven's like, we got these cool ties coming out with Drake's.
Yeah. That was the very first Hodinkee collaboration.
Indeed it was.
Yeah.
Indeed it was.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So what year was that? Can we place that?
2012.
That was fall 2012, yeah.
Okay. So after I graduated... And you were full time. Yep. That makes sense.
And you had your 3940G.
3940G, 2012.
Graduation.
Still have it.
Yep. That's good.
We went to, where did we go? Oh, the Goodwood.
We went to Goodwood
IWC.
With IWC.
Yes.
And then we went to Paris with Zenith. And then I got on a 4 a.m. train and took a train to Geneva and went to visit Vacheron. It was the first time I went to go see a watch manufacturer.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'd been on the job like 2 months. Showed up at Geneva having like been awake already for like 6 hours or whatever and went to a watch factory and my mind was completely blown.
Yeah, that's a good place to start, Vacheron.
Yeah,
that's a real watchmaker.
Yeah, for sure. Now we're here, sitting in Ben's office. We got a couple dozen people outside.
The impeachment on the TV.
The impeachment on TV. It's, you know, everything's happening.
So much stuff happening.
This week's episode is brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop. The Hodinkee Shop was created by watch lovers for watch lovers. It started way back in 2012 with a handful of watch straps and travel pouches, and it's grown to include dozens of strap options, tons of travel accessories, the best watch books and magazines, outstanding vintage watches, and some of the most desirable modern watches on the market today. It's truly a full-service destination for anyone interested in watches. In addition to stocking the products you want, the Hodinkee Shop is committed to making the discovery and buying process itself as fun and convenient as it can be. You can browse and shop anywhere in the world, directly on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, and the incredible photographs ensure you get a vivid, accurate look at whatever you're considering. It doesn't stop there, though. Once you've ordered a watch, you can count on complimentary, expedited shipping to get it to you as quickly as overnight. An extra year of warranty is included at no additional charge, and all of your paperwork is stored digitally, so you don't have to sweat losing those precious papers. Importantly, when it comes to modern watches, the Hodinkee Shop is an official authorized retailer for all brands it carries. This means you're guaranteed to be getting a brand new, fully authentic watch with its full warranty. There's no funny business at all. The experience is truly best in class from top to bottom, and it's what the Hodinkee Shop thinks 21st century luxury is all about. To learn more and to take a look at the full range of watches, accessories, and more, visit shop.hodinkee.com. All right, let's get back to the show. So, Eric, since then, you've made your way full-time into the watch world.
Yes.
What was that process like? Like, how did you decide, like, maybe this is something I actually want to do and can do full-time as opposed to kind of on the side late night after your day job?
It's interesting because I think... Ben obviously didn't plan for this to be full time either.
What are you talking about? This is my master plan.
Exactly. And you know, in your interview with Waco, you said once you got into Columbia, your friends were like, "Okay, I get it now. Success. And, you're all done.
Now you can stop."
And I felt this. You know, I loved watches. I always wanted it as a hobby. You know, once I got into it, but I thought that it would kind of ruin it if I did it full time. And it would almost be a betrayal of my education, and feel very differently now. Obviously, I love watches, and back in 2015, I decided to make the leap into watches full time, and I joined Christie's. It was a tough, decision. I was thinking about joining Hodinkee at the time, which had just gotten investment, and obviously. Ben is definitely one of the people I most admire in my life.
He's lying.
And
that's your first mistake right there.
Number one.
Exactly. But it was at that time, Christie seemed to make the most sense for me and what I wanted to do in vintage watches. So that was, it was a wild ride at Christie's, and we can talk about auctions and sort of that whole world in a little bit if you like, but I did that for about 2.5 years and then decided to start my own business. And now I'm a vintage watch dealer.
Wind Vintage?
Correct.
Yeah. Perfect.
Where'd you get the name?
It was a tough one. I'm not really into modern watches, so it made sense.
What watch are you wearing right now?
I'm wearing an Eterna Baby Chronograph.
That's a real little baby chronograph.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I don't know. I got this from a friend in Switzerland who found it. From the original family, so it's just pretty cool to wear something so small, and the movement's incredible. I just visited our friend Alkis to get a photo of it, and the finishing is amazing. 1940s.
Very cool.
So yeah, I mean, Ben talked at the end of December about sort of tastes and the watch world being very boring, everyone wanting Nautilus, Aquanaut, 5164, etc., and that's definitely sort of what I'm seeing as well, and I think it's important people break beyond that and develop their own tastes, as both of you said.
Yeah, is that something you actively work with clients on, is kind of like developing their taste and kind of pushing them? You know, a client comes to you and says, like, I want a Nautilus, and you say, okay, I can probably get you that, but here are like five other things you should probably look at first.
Yeah, I think, listen, I'll help people find what they're looking for, obviously, but It's very boring if everyone has the exact same tastes. And I do think a Nautilus is an important part of a collection. If you're going to have, 10 to 20 watches, that's I really love the watch myself. I'm not an Aquanaut fan, but I love the Nautilus. I love GMTs, subs, Explorers, you know, all the iconic models. But then there's a whole wide world beyond that that I absolutely love, you know, things like Hoyer chronographs from the 40s or the sort of iconic ones from the 60s and 70s or Anikars I've been getting into recently and all kinds of really cool and unusual stuff that you won't see other people wearing.
Nice. How did that fit in when you were with an auction house, right? Because like there you have to kind of balance getting people into new and interesting things and like finding the stuff that's interesting to you, yeah. but also making sure that these things achieve numbers, right?
Yes,
like you can't be pushing people too hard, right?
No,
otherwise
exactly.
You just don't make your numbers.
It was not. So I ended with Christie's in 2017 and the sort of herd mentality was honestly not as bad then as it is today. And we had a thematic auction in 2016 that was Nautilus for the 40th anniversary of the Nautilus. And by the time the fourth, we basically put 10 Nautilus watches in each sale location. So 10 in Geneva, 10 in Dubai, then Geneva, then Hong Kong and New York. And by the time New York rolled around, we were really working hard to sell those because no one wanted them. Yeah. And
things were different.
So that wasn't the same. I mean, obviously nice subs and GMTs and Daytonas did well, but it wasn't the hysteria that it became a few years later. There was a lot more broad thinking and we were kind of seeing the rise of value of different things like Speedmasters really increased a lot during that time and Hoyers and other brands in a very stable way, I feel like. And then when you get too much hype and hysteria, that's where you get the softening prices has been referenced 6263s a couple weeks ago coming down, et cetera. There's too much herd thinking, I would say.
And I think, you know, it's rare that we have somebody that's kind of like a recovering auction employee, I would say, on the mic. So just to clear things up so that people understand, you as an auction house person, do you represent the buyer or the seller?
We absolutely represent the seller.
Yeah. So I think like that's something that I kind of learned early on in my career, not from Eric, but from other folks at Christie's and elsewhere. I'd buy a watch and they just like wouldn't tell me what the real story was, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember buying the Vacheron, the 4240. And, you know, I had spent, back then a fortune for me on that thing. And it didn't work. It wasn't even close to working.
Yeah.
And I was just like, guys, like, why wouldn't you tell me this? And they were like, we don't have to tell you that. And that's the thing that I don't think people really understand about auctions, whether it's car auctions or anything. You represent the seller.
Yes.
And the buyer is just, they're just there. They just make the transaction happen.
Yep. And that was the most frustrating thing about working for the auction house was the amount of things beyond your control.
Yeah.
So I probably had to say I'm sorry more in those 2 years than the whole rest of my life combined for things beyond my control.
Yeah.
So people don't know, for instance, that if someone pays late or doesn't pay, the auction house is not on the hook, for instance, for giving you the money. And I had, situations where late payment is very, very common and got worse over the time frame I was at Christie's or non-payment. And because there really aren't consequences, they'll ban you from bidding again, but they're not going to come after you for the money. They're just not going to because it's too much work legally and too difficult to get that money. So, I've had situations where a watch sold, say, for $40,000 and the people went and spent that money on something else, assuming they'd get a check in 35 days. And then the guy ghosts, basically. And in that situation, you can say, we'll reoffer the watch in 6 months. And the watch is sort of quasi-burned because it already came up. Or you give it back to the owner and they're... Or you try to sell it to an underbidder who in many cases does not want to buy it because they don't know what the true price was because they were driven up by this ghost bidder, basically. And then you can all you can say is, I'm sorry. It's really tough. And then you have all the things beyond your control, like catalog production, the team that does the digital formation of the catalogs accidentally moved the photo so it was over part of the text and then the catalog prints and you didn't catch that and all this sort of stuff and you've got angry consigners.
Yeah, that of course impacts, how
the watch it affects presented. Exactly. And that's just tough. Yeah.
How do you think it's different now that you're sort of a private seller, that you can control the whole process? How do you view it as, like, what are the biggest differences in your mind?
Yeah, I guess from a macro level, I do feel that things are sort of swinging against the watch auctions right now, because there are so many huge forces that favor direct sale of the watch, either from dealers to collectors or collector to collector. And that is one, obviously, the rise of Instagram. So people know who is collecting these watches. Things like Talking Watches, obviously, with different collectors. Rani Madhvani should probably write a big check to Hodinkee, because everyone and their neighbor writes Rani if they have some sort of funky, unusual AP or Cartier or something else. So he can buy all these things directly from random people that offer them to him. And the same with, you know, Jason Singer and Bubble Backs and Goldberger and all kinds of interesting watches. So you know who buyers are on the other side. Whereas a decade ago, no one knew who the buyers were. It was just the auction houses held that information strictly to themselves. And then there were a few dealers who kind of knew some of the big buyers, but not all. But we're in a much more transparent world where I get a watch and I can say these are the five people I think would likely buy it, and I can offer it to them without having to go through a 6-month consignment process to the auction house, and the risk that the watch gets stolen or damaged during the preview, which happens, unfortunately, and, you know, giving up 25% plus to the auction house, their buyer's premium that they charge. And then you don't get paid for another sort of 35 to 45 days after that if the buyer pays on time, which they may not. So,
sounds
yeah.
great.
Yeah, yeah right.
sounds awesome.
I mean, that's yeah. another thing that I think most people don't realize about the auction game is if you consign something, like, you're without the watch and without any money for 6 months,
yep.
a year yep. sometimes. Like, yep. This is a long process.
It really is.
It's also, you know, I mean, a question we get asked often is Hodinkee going to do auctions, right? I mean, it would kind of make sense in our portfolio. Aurel has asked me that, and the answer is, like, resolutely just no.
Yeah.
It's not a business we want to get into. Like, first of all, like, Eric just kind of, you know, extolled the idea that, like, on the consumer side it sucks, but even from a business perspective it ain't that great.
No.
You know, I mean, like, these margins are paper thin. You know, if you're a qualified seller, you're negotiating basically zero cost of selling
yep.
it. Like, the auction doesn't make anything on that. And then it's like you got to travel around the world to promote this stuff to make paper thin margins. You know, like, the amount of money that Phillips or Christie's or whoever will spend on, like, a big ticket item is just enormous.
It is.
And you hope it works. You just hope.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like if you know, in many cases, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it could be 2 to 3 guys that are driving up a $10 million price.
Yep.
And if one of those guys' kids get sick that day and he just misses the auction, it's over. Everything changes, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
And it's just a wild, like, unpredictable business that it just feels like from last century to me, you know?
It does. Yeah.
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 And especially for watches where there's a real market and things are trading hands frequently. Whereas, like, if you look at the art world, like, auctions make sense in a world where, like, there is one whatever masterpiece by Picasso or yeah. Rothko or whatever, and, like, it sells once every 40 years and we have no idea what it's worth right. on today's market. But, like, you know, a gilt Submariner, right? Like, we know what that costs. Like, there's no reason for that to have a variable price.
No, I agree. And it's that's definitely the trend, I feel like, at the moment.
Yeah.
Well, I want to dig into some specific watch talk. So one thing I want to do is, if we've got anytime you have a group of collectors or enthusiasts or whatever, you'll have more opinions than you have people. But when it comes to vintage watches, especially vintage Rolex, there are many schools of thought, but two big schools of thought. And you guys represent kind of those two schools of thought. So we've got Ben, who's a dial guy, and we've got Eric, who's a case guy.
That's true.
So yes. What I want to do is, while I have both of you here, can you each make a case for why either the case or the dial is for you the thing? And then I want you guys to kind of go out of here.
Very impressed with this, Steven.
Yeah, you know.
This is good. Yeah.
You know, I've got both of you here.
About this,
I got to do this.
Okay, go for it.
All right. Hey, I don't like starting.
No. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so for me, and to be clear, I care about case quality. It's not like I want, like, some shiny over polished blob of a case.
Yeah.
But I think to me, the dial is like the other name for the dial that many people call it is the face, right? This is the face of the watch. This is in many cases the personality of the watch. It is, you know, in many cases the defining traits of what any watch can be. An explorer is an explorer because of those 3, 6, 9 right on the dial, right? And so I think in you get so much of the personality from the face or the dial. And I think, you know, for me, those little intricacies and ins and outs are, they really define what a watch can be. Again, I'm completely appreciative of spectacularly like unmolested cases, et cetera. But the first and foremost for me, a dial really can make a watch. And, you know, I've Eric and I've had this conversation many times. You know, you can swap out dials, you can't swap out cases, or, you know, depends on how you kind of define it. But again, to me, it is like the defining characteristic of any watch. I mean, think of like the Paul Newman. The Paul Newman is the Paul Newman because of that dial. It's not because of the case. You know, in many cases, the Patek's less so. The dials aren't maybe as interesting, but most of the watches that we all really, really love and know, Speedmaster, Seamaster, Submariner, Daytona, et cetera, it's all about the dials. And you see that this also really interesting kind of price variance based on the dials. Obviously, the Paul Newman being, you know, first and foremost, but even in, you know, Gilt Submariners versus Matt, and then you go underlines, and there's all these little things that can make them more interesting. So as somebody that is exposed to watches, and this could just be a product of me being me, somebody that is exposed to watches ad nauseum, I mean, just like overexposed to watches, you see unpolished cases often. You don't see them that often, but you see them. Yeah. But when you see a new dial variant, it's actually really exciting. It's just like, wow, this is a thing I didn't know. Or then you begin to realize that like this dial variant only existed for, you know, the serial range or this year range, et cetera. And it gets exciting. And I think, you know, for people that are buying one Submariner in their lifetime, I could see a case being more important than a dial. But for somebody that will own 30, which I probably have at this point, you know, it's about the dial for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
I mean, I agree with what Ben said. I mean, I really like the proportions of the case. The bevel. I mean, certain watches for me really need the unpolished or nearly unpolished case. Like a Submariner, that's vintage. I love the chamfered edges or beveled edges. GMTs as well. Other watches are not so important on that front for me. Daytonas and Explorers, because they never had those bevels, so it doesn't really affect you when you're looking at the watch if it's been lightly polished. And the dial is absolutely critical, because if you have a really destroyed dial but a great case, that also kills the watch. So for me, it goes hand in hand. But I think the problem with a lot of vintage watches is they have been over polished, and usually a watch is kind of sympathetic to one polish in its life. A lot of these steel sport watches, once you get to two polishes, it gets very rounded. The lug holes and the crown guards get soft. And you see that with, for instance, a lot of vintage Sea Dwellers, where the crown guards almost look like pointed crown guards because they've been polished so much and it looks terrible. I think it's a little bit of a mislabel to say I'm just a case guy, obviously, and Ben's not.
Eric
Wynn,
just a case guy.
That's the headline. That's the episode title. Yeah. Eric Wynn, just a case guy. Case guy.
But to me, it all goes hand in hand. And I guess with time, I mean, what I like is, obviously, it's very special when a watch is new old stock. That's very few and far between. But I personally like to wear watches that show some scratches, that show life, that show a cohesion between all parts of the watch, the bezel, the case, the dial, that show it's lived its life together, rather than sort of these cyborg watches where you see like a brand new bezel insert, but the dial and case show wear, or vice versa, all these different things that people, you know, do to swap things around. And I mean, I also like to wear a watch where I feel like I can wear it and it can get a little scratch or whatever, and I've affected the value absolutely zero. And I think that's how a lot of people view it as well. Versus one thing I dislike about the modern market is having to buy this watch and like protect it, you know, with my right hand, like act if I scratch this watch, I'm going to lose $5,000 in value. And I think a lot of people don't want to live that way.
Yeah, I don't want to live that way.
Yeah, me neither. I agree. I'm a big proponent of like, if you can't wear it and enjoy it and like scratch it every once in a while, like don't buy it.
Yeah,
buy something
exactly.
else.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
You're not going to enjoy it.
No, exactly. So
while we're talking about quality, another thing I wanted to talk about, and Ben and I have talked about this before on the podcast, is restoration. So I'd love to get your thoughts. You know, there's full on redials, there's resurfacing, there's retouching, there's relooming. And then with cases, there's, you know, laser sintering, so you can kind of rebuild up some of that metal that's been lost. What are your thoughts overall on, you know, maybe where the market's been and where it's going on kind of retouched or restored watches?
I mean, there's a lot of people that are very motivated to promote restored watches. The whole industry itself is sort of trying to promote that because, you know, you talk to dealers and collectors, but more on the dealer side, and they say there's just not enough watches out there to support this whole industry of people that are buying and reselling, and
more exactly to support them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, the perfect interesting example of that was the 6062 that was at Christie's Geneva with a relume dial and restored case, etc. To me, that's a watch that shouldn't have sold nearly where it sold, you know, almost $1 million after selling for $300,000 in, I think, May 2015. But, you know, people want to promote that. And obviously, I think there is a place for some limited but transparent restoration of watches. I'm not a big fan of all the casework because it, to me, ends up making it look like a sort of cyborg watch where it's like this new old stock looking case and then everything else shows wear. If you have a watch though, for instance, that has, you know, pitting due to rust, I mean, the steel mixture they used in the 1940s was much more susceptible to rust from the carbon. It was a higher carbon concentration. And I can see sort of remediating that, like you would remediate a situation in a home or in a car, rust situation or something, to make it sort of stabilize. There is a lot of, I mean, the other thing I will say that I years ago was not so, I guess, sympathetic to, but reluming has gotten very good of hands, and obviously there's radium and tritium floating around. I think when you have a watch that does not have lume in the hands, you know, Ben's Fullerton Tri-Compax is a good example of that, which he bought at Sotheby's, I think, in 2012. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't like the sort of skeletonized look of the hands. And these watches, to me, the lume, I see people get very upset that the lume is out of the hands or has fallen out of the hands even while they own it. If they bump into something or they drop the watch, the lume falls out. Or a careless watchmaker sort of putting the hands back on knocks it out. And to me, these people are ready to commit suicide if there's like a tiny hole that their watchmaker bumps, things like that. I just think that is one of the sort of flaws of these sport watches. They were never meant to have the lume last 500 years in these things. The movements can last 500 years and the dials can last a long time and everything else. But, you know, if the watch has no lume in the hands, I'll typically, if I have a client for it, ask if they want it sort of matched. You know, it can be matched with just paint or, you know, tritium that looks similar to the dial, and just be transparent about it. But to me, that shouldn't be the make or break thing on the watch. It's more important about everything else.
How do you feel about reluming like plots?
I don't like doing that at all. I know people do it for sure, and then obviously do not describe it when they're selling it. I don't think it's that easy to do because you really risk scraping the dial when you're removing it. Yeah, I think it's very, very dangerous. It never looks right either. Usually you can see that the texture or the way it sits on the dial isn't right.
How about you, Ben? Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I think preferably no relumed anything.
Yeah, you know? Of course. That's.
I think that there's a certain charm. I mean, my tastes have changed a lot over the last few years. Like I now, instead of buying like looking to buy the most mint examples of stuff, I'm looking to buy really good examples that I can wear kind of without too much aggravation. So, you know, I have a watch or two that probably has color matched hands probably. I hope I don't have anything that's been relumed, but I probably do somewhere in there. But, you know, I, preferably, you know, at this point, I don't buy as many vintage watches as I used to, and I typically buy them from Eric or people that I really trust, and I'm told that they are, you know, original owner or one degree away from original owner. So, you know, I'm buying so few vintage watches, I don't have to deal with it so much. But yeah, I mean, I understand why people would reloom, you know, in particular on Daytonas. That's kind of what I'm referring to. It's like the idea that like a Daytona, even a mint one, like unpolished, will say full box papers watch is unsellable if one loom plot is bruised or missing is asinine, of course. Yep. But that's kind of the world that we're living in right now, in particular with like a lot of the younger collectors and like, you know, the guys in Asia, et cetera. Like they want mint watches and they won't even look at it if something is off. So I understand why a dealer could be compelled to just fix one loom plot and sell it for a lot of money, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned original owner or one step away from original owner. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's always intrigued me. And for the longest time, I thought, you know, it was just sort of a fetishistic sort of thing. Like, oh, it's coming from the original source. There's something romantic about that. But, you know, having been around this now for a few years, I think one of the main advantages to this that people might not understand is we so often see the same watch a million times. Mm-hmm. You know, like over the last 5 years, there are certain watches I've seen 3, 4, 5, 6 times up for sale. And by buying something that's from the original owner or that a dealer has sourced from the owner, you're avoiding all of these mishaps that can happen, right? Like you're avoiding the relooming, you're avoiding the laser sintering, you're avoiding having paperwork tampered with, like, because normal people don't even know to do those things.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, you know, those actions would have been taken by dealers. And in many cases, it would have been done in the 90s or the 80s or, you know, the early 2000s when, like, there just wasn't a world to care about. Yep. You know, and people just didn't care back then. It wasn't a big deal. Yeah. And, you know, if you talk about, like, let's take a 1518 or a 2499, like, I would guess that three dealers in Italy have touched more than half of, say, the 1518 yellows in the world. Like, I really mean that, you know? And so, like, if those guys are into fixing up cases or polishing or whatever for, you know, 10 years of their career, then, like, 50% of those watches have not issues, but have had some work done to it. And that just is. And, you know, the idea of dial swapping, you know, you have a killer unpolished 6241 regular dial, and then you find an amazing 6239 Paul Newman, put the dial in the 6241, like, that's just what people did. And it wasn't a big deal. And, you know, now, like, we know those watches are in the market. We know it still happens. But if people found out, they would freak out. They would explode that they you know, have a watch that the dial's been swapped on. It just didn't matter back then. And that's the biggest thing that's changed, is, like, people expect everything to actually be untouched. And they, like, if they really knew what was happening, you know, over the past 20 years, they would be shocked.
Yep. No, it's true. And we at Christie's would have people come back with watches they bought in the 1990s even, and we would say, you know, it'd be like a Noyster 6263 with a 6239 dial in it and other things like that. And we'd look in the records, it sold in 1999, and there just wasn't scholarship around about that. Fortunately, the watch was generally worth more than what people paid then, just given the value of the parts, but not worth nearly as much as they thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, it was the wild, wild west until very recently. It really was. I mean, I wrote about it in the magazine. You know, I love vintage Cartier, like many people in this room, and, like, to find an authentic vintage Cartier, I'm talking, like, pre-69, impossible. Like, absolutely impossible. And in many cases, these things come with documentation from Cartier archives.
Yes.
Which is bananas, you know? And then, you know, I obviously know people at Cartier, they'll say, that watch was never made. And I'm like, but I've got a document from Cartier Paris. And they're like, that's why we stopped doing those.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not Cartier. Like, Patek, you know, the archives, look, there are guys that we all know that used to pay people in the archives to produce these things.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know? What's 20 grand if you're talking about $1 million watch?
Yeah. Yep. No, it's true.
Yep.
Right? You know? That's 20 grand. If you're talking about $1 million.
I know. I'm just get it. You get 20 grand. You get 20 grand. Gray does not get 20 grand. But so with all this in mind, I mean, we talked about, you know, how the dealers have kind of a vested interest in this and how maybe tastes are changing a little bit. Do you guys think that this is going to end up like the car market or the art market, where, like, restoration and making sure these things are in, like, quality, stable condition, and in some cases, like, aesthetically pleasing condition, is going to become normal just because as this thing grows and matures? Or do you think watches will always, at least at a certain level, maintain this sense of, like, purity and untouched mysticism, maybe?
I mean, one thing that really could affect the market, and obviously people have toyed with it over the years, is doing some sort of grading system like PSA did with baseball cards and they do with comic books and authenticating autographs and coins and currency. Those markets absolutely skyrocketed after there was sort of third-party grade. Obviously, it's the same with gems and jewelry, the fact you can get a grade from any number of labs and determine where the stone is from. And that really affected the market. I don't know if anything's in the works at all regarding watches. There's obviously always a lot of banter, but that could change things. But the key thing is, of course, not to corrupt the people doing the grading. And it's very hard, obviously, to say this watch was born with this dial. You can't, unless you've owned it that whole time or have very good sourcing of it.
Yeah, and I think also, like, another market that I obviously pay attention to is collector cars. And, like, there's been real pushback against these over-restored cars. Like, you know, Ralph Lauren, in many cases, was kind of like the patron saint of, like, hyper-restoration, like, making these things brand new. And in many cases, I mean, he still has, you know, top 10 car collection in the world, but a lot of these guys have really pushed back on that. It's like, these things, they look like jewelry now, as opposed to things that, like, you can get in and go out to dinner in, you know? Yeah. And so in many cases in the car world, unrestored cars that are mechanically sound will do better than, you know, jewelry-like cars. So I think the car world is changing dramatically. Meanwhile, you know, a hyper-restored 250 GTO is still worth $50 million plus. It's not like you're cutting these values in half. So I think watches will find kind of a nice settling point where it's like pure original owner unrestored stuff is going to be great. But I think, as Eric said, like, you know, you need to have these things functional. You need the movements to work. No rust, you know, like if the hands are about to fall off or the crown's about to fall off, like, of course you want to, you know, if you want to use it, you need to replace it. You know, I would love there to be more transparency. I mean, Alex Chiani, who we all know is kind of like the guy in restoration, at least in the United States, he was really pushing hard for it. I don't know, you know, whatever really kind of came of it. But, you know, there are guys that really believe in it. And I do get it. You know, I kind of made the joke about, like, it won't support the dealers' Ferrari buying habits, but, like, so many people want vintage watches right now, and there just truly aren't that many.
Yeah.
And so to not have the joy of owning a 6239 or 6263 because it's been relumed or whatever, like, is it worth it? I don't know. I think it's all about being transparent and people, like, knowing exactly what they have. And, like, if somebody offered me a 6239 Paul Newman that was box papers, whatever, but had been relumed, but the price was commensurate with that, I don't know. Like, I might buy it. You never know. You know, it's something that I would at least consider. You just want to know exactly what it is, you know?
Yeah. So before we wrap up, because we're running out of time here, Eric, while we have you, I wanted to get, can you give us three recommendations for watches that are maybe under the radar that people should look into? Watches that you're really interested in, things that you think, they don't have to have huge financial upside in the future, but just, like, cool stuff that presents good value for somebody who wants to buy a watch that they can wear and enjoy.
And preferably if you have them in the bag right there.
Yeah,
if you
exactly.
have them in that suitcase,
yeah, exactly.
Even better.
It's hard to... I mean, I don't know if I could spoil a future Hodinkee article I'm
don't
writing
spoil
for
that
Joy.
One.
Yeah, don't spoil that one. So, we're keeping that under wraps.
All right, so that's still in progress. I mean, I think that there are watches like Ennekar chronographs that are and dive watches from the 1960s and 70s that are extremely interesting, very rare. But it's as sort of things... I've seen it happen with different markets. Ben has as well. You know, Hoyer chronographs 7 years ago, there were a ton around. And you could, any day of the week, buy different watches like Carreras and Monacos and Octavias. But that dried up as sort of prices went up and people began hoarding them. I think that we're still in a place where Ennekars are not at that level, where there's still, like, abundant supply of good ones.
Sure.
And... another watch I really love, but it is hard to find really nice ones, are Titus Calypsomatics, and they're really incredible dive watches. I mean, really similar in construction and build to Rolex Submariners. I've got one from the 1960s. It's got a very large crown. I mean, I've had famous people like Jeff Hess say, you know, like 5 feet
that
away,
famous?
Say, is that in our watch world? Say, oh, what is that? And, you know, he's thinking it's like a 5510 or something, like his own watch. But then he looks closer and he's like, if you ever want to sell that, let me know. So there's still, you know, very exciting things. I guess third recommendation would be Rolex Explorers, which I really like.
Those
and
suck.
You like.
Yeah, whatever. Ben, all right.
I hate those.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Tudor Rangers, I feel, are really special and underappreciated, and because there are so many fakes, it's very hard to find real ones, and they're really, really cool as well.
Nice. Good to see you. Thank you
thank
for joining
you so
us,
much.
Sir.
Yeah,
OG Hodinkee crew right here.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
We'll have to have you back soon.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This week's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.